Well, we've all had our maximum fun for the day. Now, how about something from the studios of minimum fun, or at least mostly cloudy fun? It's Thursday, November 6th. It's Vox Pop. We know the old saying, there's nothing certain but death and taxes. Well, doing a call-in show about death would be depressing even by my standards. So let's get some tax advice from Judy Cahey and Dawn Doherty from BST, an accounting, business advisory, and management consulting firm in Latham, New York. You know, tax time, it's a-coming. Give us a call with your question, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551 if you have a tax question, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. It's Judy Cahey, it's Dawn Doherty, and your tax planning calls coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. On today's show, we get some tax tips from BST, an accounting, tax, and financial services consulting firm. Judy Cahey is a partner at BST. She has a master's of taxation from UAlbany and brings nearly 30 years' experience in the areas of individual, corporate, partnership, not-for-profit, and estate and tax, trust taxation, that is. She works with closely held or family-owned businesses, not-for-profits, high-net-worth individuals. Also a partner at BST, Dawn Doherty primarily focuses on medium and large business enterprises, including multi-state and multinational structures. Having spent several years as a senior-level IRS agent, she brings extensive tax controversy expertise to the role. Dawn is a former adjunct professor at UAlbany, where she taught individual income tax and corporate taxation. These two know their business. If you have a question, call now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But the number again is 800-348-2551. Judy and Dawn, welcome back. How are you?
We are good. How are you?
How's business? Everything good?
Busy, busy. We had a big tax bill this summer, so yeah. we're on our toes.
Yeah, you know, and the big, beautiful bill changes some things, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Yeah. There are a lot of things you want to get talking about. This email came in a while back, and it's gobbledygook to me, being a poor man myself. I have no idea what this means, but I'll read it to you. And this is from Larry. Can you please ask your guests about the new rules / compliance for employees who are making catch-up contributions to their 401k/403b? The new rule states that amounts contributed on wages after $145,000 must be deposited into a post-tax Roth account, which is no longer giving the employee a tax break for being able to make those contributions. This falls under the Secure Act 2.0, Section 603. Wow, Larry did his homework. All right, what do you think?
He did. So, yes, indeed, we have some new rules kicking in here with respect to those with income over that threshold that he mentioned, $145,000. So, if you are over the age of 50, you can generally, age 50 and older, do an extra $7,500. They've bumped up a little bit more for those between the ages of 60 and 63. You can do an extra $11,250. But both of those catch-ups, whether or not you're making the $7,500 or the $11,250, that portion has to be to a Roth account. So that's after-tax dollars. On the flip side, right, when you make a contribution to a 401k and it's not a Roth, when the dollars come out, every dollar you get is taxable. However, with the Roth piece, when the dollars come out, there's not taxable as long as they're used for qualified retirement. So it is a new provision that kicks in January 1st to be aware of for those that make over that $145,000 threshold in wages.
So is this a six of one, half dozen of the other? Basically, it's pre-tax or post-tax?
Well, it's pre-tax or post-tax, yeah. But time and age matter here.
Yeah, right. I guess you want to consider what your tax bracket's going to be or what you anticipate it to be in your retirement years. So for a number of individuals who are just starting out, maybe a Roth is a great idea. Your earnings can build tax-free during your working years. And a number of people also consider the right time to convert a traditional IRA to a Roth IRA, and there's some calculus to be done there to see if it's worthwhile. If you've contributed throughout your working years to a traditional IRA, all of that was generally deposited into that traditional tax-free. So there has to be a toll to be paid at some point in time.
And somehow we're always going to pay the toll, aren't we?
Yes, we are.
One way or another.
Yeah, I noticed that. So there are many changes ahead, and maybe you could, before we get to the phones, give us just a brief précis of some of the ones that may really affect many of us.
So as I was prepping today, Ray, to come down here, I thought about the first time I came on your show in 2018, we were talking about this thing called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and it just passed and what it meant.
Yeah.
Most of that was all set to sunset 12/31/25.
Oh, yeah.
This legislation that passed this year, extended a whole bunch of the things that were set to expire, as well as B, delivered on some campaign promises on the topics of tips and overtime and some other things. So this is really a continuation of extending the tax brackets and eliminating the exemptions. And
so salt is still an issue here, especially in
places. Salt is still an issue, but it's not as bad an issue for the, I'll call it the average earner. But once you get to the higher brackets, the salt, and you're referring to the salt cap. And
right.
For those of our listeners, we're not talking about a chapeau that's made of briny material.
No.
We're talking about the state and local tax
cap
on the itemized deductions. For that, there has been an increase as a result of the One Big Beautiful Bill, $40,000 instead of $10,000. But there is phase out for our higher earner individuals.
Right.
So it's still an item of discussion.
Any other major changes you want to highlight before we hit the phones?
We should talk briefly about the tips and the overtime provision, because these are making some real
How would
news.
You enforce that? How would you? How
the
would
tips
you...
is going to be tough. Just this week, 2 days ago, we saw some guidance from the IRS. You got to keep in mind this legislation was signed July 4th.
Right.
But these provisions on tips and overtime go back to 1/1. And so the guidance that came out is the IRS isn't going to impose penalties in 2025. They're redesigning the W-2. But P.S., that isn't coming out for 25. It's not going to come out for one more year to 2026. So 2025, W-2s are going to go out to employees, and they're not going to have boxes for the tips and the overtime, as you would anticipate. And they're encouraging employers to basically voluntarily report that information. But tips is a tough one. It's also tough because a tip that's discretionary counts, but a tip that's not. So think of going into a restaurant, got a party of six, right? You get an automatic gratuity to your bill. That doesn't count. So the administration of this is going to be a challenge.
So will all tips then have to be not cash? I mean, you go to a local restaurant, you go to the tavern around the corner, and the waiter is going to get mostly cash. They'll split it up at the end of the night.
Right.
He might bring home 50, 60 bucks. Who's going to keep track of that?
Well, that's a good question. And, unfortunately, it falls to employers in many cases to sort of track what sorts of tips are running through their organization. There's an awful lot of self-reporting that has to go on from the employees and or the individuals. This can be self-employed individuals, too, who are in a profession that's in one of the qualified professions. And bear in mind, not all tipped professions qualify.
So blackjack dealers and things like that.
Yes, those do qualify.
Yeah.
There are 70. The list came out. There are 70. And DJ non-radio was on there, but radio show host was not Ray.
It's all right. We don't make any money anyway. It doesn't matter. It's fine.
But the number is 25,000 is the deduction of no tax
max.
On tips,
yeah.
max.
Yeah.
There is an income phase out of about 300,000 married filing joint. Similarly, there's a deduction on overtime up to $12,500 per person, $25,000 married filing joint on qualified overtime. The only thing I'd point out to your listeners on that, it's a little bit quirky.
It is.
You know, if you're an hourly employee and you get time and a half, let's say hypothetically, you know, your rate is 10, you get time and a half 15, and it's the $5 differential, the
right.
half that counts, not the full 15.
Well, understood.
On time and a half. So there's rules around how that gets computed. And to Don's point, it's on the employer to sort of track that, but that's a little bit easier to track than chips.
All right, now we'll get to the phones, and I promise, and I'm sorry to harp on this tax thing, but the minute it was announced during the campaigns that this was going to be a thing, I said, well, this is going to be a quagmire. Now, Dawn, you said this is really going to be up to some extent the employers who to track this stuff. What's the incentive for them to do that?
Well, there's always incentive or disincentive not to. You know, for this year in particular, I think the government's giving employers a little bit of leeway because the forms haven't been updated and these rules are new. So it's giving employers some time to adjust. Since 2025, we're going back to the beginning of the year for some of these provisions. Thereafter, I would expect that it would be the full force of penalties for failure to comply.
But I mean, must be, if somebody gets audited, it would be, mm-hmm. you know, it's up to the person who's getting audited to bring as much documentation as possible.
Correct.
But how would the government say, oh, yeah, well, we think you made X in tips? Well, prove that, Mr. IRS.
It's not an easy thing to do, for certain. There are different audit methodologies that can be undertaken in order to determine whether or not we have a lifestyle that matches what the income is.
All right. Well, let's take a break here and we'll get to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. VoxPop at WAMC.org is the email address. Taxes with Judy Cahey and Dawn Daugherty. Your questions coming up. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you. Taxes today with Judy Cahey and Dawn Daugherty of BST. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. A couple quick emails. Now, I'll tell you what, John in Malta has been waiting a very long time. John, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So like a lot of New Yorkers, we receive a $300 check from New York State for the inflation kickback, whatever they want to call it.
Right.
I have a question about that. They say, you know, hang on to your stub for tax purposes. So a three-part question. Is that going to be state and or federal taxed? My guess is maybe fed, but not the state. Second of all, are we going to receive a W-2 or 1099 or something? Or is there sort of a special way to how do we manage that when we report? And the last question is a little different. There was some criticism, I think, of Hochul or her administration. But from people that said that, well, if she gave out the money in a different way, it wouldn't be taxed federally. Can you comment on that?
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't anticipate, let me start with number two. I wouldn't anticipate you're going to get any sort of a statement in the mail that's going to help you with this. So for New York State tax purposes, the payment is exempt. For federal tax purposes,
right.
The answer is it depends, right? You have to look to whether or not you itemized on your federal return or not,
okay.
and go from there. The third one, a little bit of a political answer, so I'm going
to... Well, but maybe technically, could it have been done, if it were done a different way,
yeah.
Would it have been managed differently?
If it was a tax credit, you wouldn't be paying on it, right?
Generally speaking, yeah, that is a possibility. There's a variety of ways that government can move to economically assist their citizens. This was the way that was chosen.
All right. John, you all
okay.
right?
Okay. So, you know, how would that question come up on the federal? Like, you know, did you gamble and bring any money home? What might the question look like? did your state give you $300 kickback?
Yeah, I mean, this has happened before where we've gotten some of our own money back in the form of a check.
Yeah, we've seen it on the real property tax side, right? I mean, we've seen it certainly from New York State on the property side. And again, it's one of those documents you have to put in your pile. And, you know, I don't know what kind of software you use or if you use a tax professional. If you use a tax professional, certainly give them that number.
Right.
If you, I'm not sure how a TurboTax or something would prompt the question, did you get a tax refund, and to give them that number. So they.
I've seen it pop up on TurboTax before.
There's a tax benefit rule there that if you claim an itemized deduction and get a deduction for it on your federal, then the receipt back of it would be income.
All right, John.
Got it. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. That's the number. 800-348-2551. Don Daugherty and Judy Cahey are here, and I believe they're going to be back in February, mid-February. We'll do some look-ahead tax planning. But today is, well, you're already in trouble, so we'll try to make it easy on you. This is from Gina, who writes in from the 914. Well, the day finally came when I had to put my husband in a memory care facility. Sorry, Gina. I started paying in October, and so we'll have 3 months of payments in 2025. It is an exorbitant amount. Is this or any portion of it deductible? If not, why is our country so incredibly bad for both child care and elder care? I know that's another show, says Gina, but great question. In general, this type of expense, deductible?
Generally speaking, yes. Bear in mind that health and health-related itemized deductions are subject to a floor. So you have to be over that floor, your adjusted gross income, in order for the deduction to actually yield anything. So I know the expense of memory care can be quite exorbitant. And very often we find with our clients who might have individuals who are receiving either home care and or are in a nursing facility, those expenses normally are in excess of the 7.5%, adjusted gross income floor on that deduction. But the key here really is the itemizing. Without itemizing deductions, those health care costs really don't yield a tax benefit.
And I would say, just in general for your listeners, when you do your return, you claim the higher of a standard deduction or your itemized deduction. That standard deduction on a married filing joint return is $30,000, right? Mm. So the question is, in her case, is she claiming a standard deduction, or because this number is so high, will bringing that into her fact pattern cause her to itemize? And again, to Don's point, it's only to the extent you exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, and it's only the number over that becomes
correct.
Deductible. So it's a little bit of a threshold, but the numbers have to be evaluated.
Gina, hang in there, and sorry for what you're going through there. Let's go to Ken in Albany. Ken, you're on.
Hi there. Excuse me.
Nice start to the call, Ken. Nice start to the call.
Hello?
You're on. Go ahead.
All right. I have not filed my taxes since 2021. I got 3 years in arrears. I need some advice on how to clear that up, and maybe with minimizing the penalties and interest expenses.
Yeah.
I don't know of any tax accountants or attorneys in the area. I need some advice.
That's good.
Ken, I guess the real question here is whether or not you've even gotten to the point of a filing threshold for the years that you've missed. So that's one factor to consider. I don't know what your income level is, but that's always step number one, is determine, are you above the filing threshold? Now, if your income is going to be completely offset by, itemized deductions, then it's possible that that you're not going to pay any tax anyway, and or your standard deduction.
Well,
so
I'm
look at.
Go ahead, Ken.
I'm pretty sure that I got to owe taxes.
Okay. So that being the case, then, the sooner you act, the better. The bottom line is, even if the government is gracious and says you have reasonable cause, and you have to have reasonable cause for the failure to file these past tax returns, interest will still apply. That is statutory. There's no provision for avoiding that interest. So the longer you're sitting on this, the more it's costing you, because the interest rates, as you know, have increased, and that includes the federal government's and the state government's interest rates. So I would say your next course of action is to find either an accountant that can assist you, prepare your individual income tax returns as quickly as possible, examine your circumstances, and figure out, was there extenuating circumstances for not filing for those years?
What would some of those be?
Well, sometimes people are very ill. They are dealing with a family member who is very ill. They may have been out of the country for a particular reason. There's extenuating circumstances. Now, ignorance of the law doesn't work. Saying your accountant didn't do it doesn't work. Ultimately, you're responsible for filing.
And there's no statute here, Ken. So for all these years you don't file, there's no statute of limitations running. So that's dangerous territory, because if you choose not to file for a period of years, they can come back at you if you had a filing requirement.
Ken, you want to follow up?
Well, it's just that there is no legitimate reason for not filing. The fact of the matter is, I have probably a neurotic hatred. I despise the whole process of filing those ridiculous BS-laden forms. It just really irritates me so much that I can't even face it. I'd rather lose a finger or two.
Ouch.
Oh, I wouldn't do that.
Those are also
this.
Taxable, Ken. Yeah. I'm sorry. All right. Well, Dawn, you were a former IRS agent. What do you think about that?
I wouldn't lose any limbs over this, or digits for that matter. I would say, if it's something that is so loathsome to you, definitely engaging a tax preparer to help you navigate. The rules are complicated, admittedly, but it doesn't absolve you from your responsibility.
Ken, thanks a lot for the call. Ken's situation, he didn't file for 3 years. Just as a former IRS agent, and I'm not suggesting any person anywhere not file their taxes, but if it was 6, 7, 8 years and Ken's under the radar, does popping his head up and saying, oh, I'm here, I forgot to file for 8 years, does that, are they going to find you?
Eventually, even
if
you, yes.
Really? Even if it's 15, 20 years?
Yes. Ultimately, if you're receiving income from sources that are being reported to the Internal Revenue Service, there's going to be some record somewhere. Let's say it's wages. How do you receive your wages? They're reported to you on a W-2. Those wages are also reported to the government. You receive interest on a bank account. That also gets reported to the government.
Even if it's a little bit. Maybe Ken has 12 bucks in the bank.
Perhaps he does, but either way, there is generally going to be some paper trail somewhere, particularly in this digital world, of the existence of taxable income.
Yeah, a lot of payers have to file those 1090, those W-2s or 1099s you receive. A copy is filed with the IRS, so sometimes if a taxpayer has a hard time locating something, we pull transcripts, and they have all the 1099s reported in that taxpayer's ID number. It's all right there. It's a roadmap.
All right. This is, I don't know who it's from. Doesn't say. Could you please discuss the pros and cons of filing as single versus married?
Okay. So if you're married, you're either married or you're not. It's not, I'm kind of married.
Last day of tax year.
All right. Last day of the tax year, if you are considered married, you have two choices. You can either file a joint return or file separately. Married filing separately generally means you get half of all of the things that a married filing joint individual would receive. For example, your standard deduction, It's halved of what you would normally receive. The other element with married filing separately is a number of the favorable provisions, one that we spoke about earlier. You wouldn't be entitled to it. The $25,000 deduction on tips. If you're a married individual, you have to file a joint return to claim it.
Right.
Yeah. So there are a lot of provisions littered throughout the tax code that have that sort of, I'll call it exclusion.
Yeah. It's usually more tax advantageous to file. It usually is the word.
Are there any disadvantages to filing jointly?
Yes. Yes, actually. There's one. I'm going to call it, know what you're getting yourself into when you're filing a joint income tax return with your spouse. Each spouse is jointly and severally liable for the entire amount on the tax return. So if you have one party that's perhaps not doing things or putting all of the information in the tax return, the other spouse is just as liable for it you file a joint income tax return, and not just liable for your share of it, it's the whole amount. That's what is meant by joint and several. That can be disadvantageous.
Judy, you want to add anything to that?
Nope, I'll leave it there.
All right, Judy Cahy is here, and Don Daugherty from BST, an accounting, tax, and financial services consulting firm. Let's go back to our phones. Ton of emails here, and I'll get to them as we go along. Number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. James is in Saugerties. James, go ahead.
Hey, how you doing? My question is about the employee retention credit that was offered by the IRS for small businesses that stayed open during COVID.
Yes.
So after a year and a half of waiting for said monies, which were applied for and did not come, the checks came fast and furious at the beginning of this year. We don't take a lot of money from the business, so the partners, we decided that, well, this is our opportunity to take a few bucks. Our tax professional has said that we should set aside about 30% of said monies to get ready to pay that in our taxes this year. So my question is, if it's a credit, if it's a tax credit, why the 30%? And why didn't Uncle Sam just take some of this money out of the checks before they mailed it to us?
Interesting.
Judy and I are both a little perplexed by the recommendation. There are a couple of things that could be at play here. If you are in a partnership and or an S corporation and you're taking distributions yep. and they're beyond your basis, well, that's one element. If that's the case, then you may end up in a taxable situation if you're taking cash beyond your tax basis.
Go ahead. To amended returns. Were you recommended
beyond,
to amend?
Beyond tax basis.
Right.
Did you amend your returns for the years you collected those credits for?
Well, no, because we haven't seen anything really up until this year.
That very well could be why your accountant had recommended that you at least reserve for amended returns should have been filed for the tax years for which you claimed the ERC, the Employee Retention Credit. So if that failed to occur, that was one of the criteria in order to properly claim that ERC. So there could be perhaps a concern there relative to audit.
Right.
I'm
not sure how we could have amended the tax returns for those years because this is back right post-COVID.
Correct.
I'm not sure how we could have necessarily amended those returns not knowing exactly if or when we would actually receive the money.
The rule was whether or not you received it, technically speaking, the amendments should have been made.
Whether you received it or not.
Yes.
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 Correct.
That seems like it.
So the fact that we filed and we weren't one of those companies that were told we don't get it because we didn't do it properly and such, I mean, election as to how those those tax forms were filed back in those years. Is it safe to assume that it was, if we hadn't amended those returns, that we wouldn't have gotten the money?
No, that's not safe to assume, because technically speaking,
right,
the ERC credits can be audited for an extended period. Normally, the statute of limitations for audits and or assessments is 3 years from the filing date and or due date of your tax returns. But in the case of ERC, this was a special statute of limitations that gave the government a 6-year period. So we had a real mismatch in the period of time that the government could audit and or assess and basically take back those credits, and when you could go back and recoup any of the tax that you may have paid relative to it. Of course, it just brings to light the calculation and being cautious about the calculation and careful and understanding the qualifications for the credit to begin with. So,
right. So just to be safe, put
yes.
aside that 30% and hope for less.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
That's the bottom line.
All right, James, thanks for that one. We're going to take a break here in a moment. Before we do, I want to go back to Ken's issue where he hasn't filed in a few years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't have to answer this or not. I see these ads on TV, and I'm not going to name any companies because I can't remember the names, but mm-hmm. they offer services. So-and-so hasn't paid his taxes in 28 years, and he owes $300,000. They was reduced to $20,000. Is that snake oil, or is something actually going on there?
I'm not going to call it snake oil, but what I will say is that the government does have programs available for individuals and businesses, too, who perhaps get out of control relative to their tax liabilities. There are a number of ways that you can make an offer and compromise. You might be able to enter into an installment agreement and get a reduction in the amount owed. Better, you know, the government views it in the same way that a business would view it. Better to collect something than to get nothing.
All right, well, let's take a break. 800-348-2551. It's Judy Cahey. It's Dawn Daugherty from BST. And we'll be back with some email and then back to the phones. All right, ladies, can you tell me what show that this theme was from?
I cannot.
Mr. Lucky. Remember that old Henry Mancini favorite, Mr. Lucky? It's not the original version, so that probably what threw you off. Dawn Daugherty and Judy Cahey are here. We're talking tax tips today. The number is 800-348-2551. And we'll do a couple emails at voxpop@wamc.org. Rick wrote, will this year's overtime be taxable next year? Now, we talked a little about this. I have heard that we only will be taxed on our base salary, not including overtime. You can recap what we discussed.
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead, Judy.
Okay. So the no tax on overtime, how does that work? So it's up to a $12,500 deduction, $25,000 on a married filing joint return on the qualified overtime. Now, a couple things here. There's a phase out. So if your adjusted gross income is over $300,000 on a married filing joint or $150,000 on a single or head of household, you start to phase out. Qualified overtime is defined by the Fair Labor Standards Act. So only the excess of the regular rate qualifies, not, you know, just the 50%, the time and a half, not the whole amount you receive to work an hour. And this is temporary. This is 2025 to 2028. And right now we await proposed regulations. And that would be my theme for today. We had this very big tax bill get enacted. And what happens after this happens is the Treasury needs to issue regulations and guidance that say how you file, what forms look like, how you administer it. And right now, this is an area that we lack those proposed details on how to, you know, how administration of this will exactly work, other than we know they're not revising the 2025 W-2.
Judy, I know you've been doing this a long time, and so has
Just
Dawn.
Just a little bit.
How does your head not spin all
the
time?
That's why I have a laptop and a book in front of me.
Good heavens.
It's a challenge, right? It keeps you on your toes because the stuff changes.
And you like this, right? Just to be clear, you guys like this?
I like a challenge.
Okay, fair enough.
I like a challenge.
All right, we'll just leave it there. Vincent writes, Trump cited no tax on Social Security benefits. However, it may not be entirely true. Can you clarify?
Okay. So no tax on Social Security did not get enacted.
Uh-huh.
That became a little bit complicated.
Why?
Because of how it's administered. So instead, they did a substitute. It's a deduction for seniors 65 and over. It's a temporary $6,000 exemption. It happens for tax years 2025 to 2028. However, here's my big however, it phases out at $150,000 of married filing joint income and $75,000 for all others. So there is something in it for seniors. It's just not exactly as described, no tax on Social Security.
Okay. Bobby writes in, my wife and I had a baby last spring, threw off my tax timing. Can I file my 2024 taxes before the end of this year? What penalties should I expect?
Are we talking 2024 or 2025?
Well, he says still late on 2024 taxes.
But delayed on it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Again, this comes back to our earlier listener who was behind. The sooner you get this done, the less painful it'll be.
Congratulations on the baby, by the way, Bobby. That's great. One more email, then we'll go back to the phones. Judy Cahey and Dawn Doherty join us, 800-348-2551. Phil writes, tax considerations when spouse recently passed. We have filed our own tax reports for over 20 years. We've always filed jointly. Both of us have been retired for over 15 years. My wife recently died. Sorry, Phil. Are there any tax considerations that I need to be aware of considering my current circumstances?
So for 2025, you can file a married filing joint return. There's some rules around timing of collection of income. So for example, if your wife had an asset in her name and it paid income in her Social Security number subsequent to her death, that gets reported not on your 1040. So income she earned during 2025 post-death gets a separate reporting on a 1041. Married filing joint is an option for 2025 tax filing. Beyond that, obviously, looking forward to 2026 and status and rates and brackets, all that needs to be planned for.
Okay, and then we'll go to the phones in a moment, but this just came in from Mark in Messina, who says, I used to work in collections at the New York State Tax Department. Worst job I ever had. If the IRS adjusts your taxes and sends you a bill for tax due, an audit, they send the New York State Tax Department updated information relating to their audit. It may take several years, but you will eventually get a bill from the New York State Tax Department. The state is, all caps, relentless in collecting back due taxes. And that's from Mark in Messina.
So they're sharing agreements,
yes,
right? And in fact, I recently saw one for a client who got a notice from California that they learned that they had Pennsylvania taxes due and California was keeping it to remit it to the state of Pennsylvania. So not only does the federal government talk with New York State, the states share data between them so that if you owe a tax authority money, sometimes you could have it adjusted a different way.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to refrain from any comment now, and we'll go right to the phones. 800-348-2551. Carl in East Greenbush. Carl, you're on.
Hello. I got two questions. One is, I'm 67. My wife is 65. We're looking at having to getting to take Social Security sometime soon, mm-hmm, and we just want to figure out how to determine that.
So my recommendation.
Question.
Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, please.
Go ahead.
The other question is, I have a lot of deferred income that I will have to pay taxes on when I withdraw, and I'm wondering if it would be smart to move all or part of it in some way that reduces the tax load.
Well,
they're looking at each other, Carl.
There's a couple of facets here
to
what we're talking about. There really isn't an age at which, you know, you're compelled, you can start taking your Social Security age 62 and older. The timing for doing so, of course, depends on what works for you. And it sounds like you have other sources of retirement income. If your deferred comp is in an IRA or other type of employer plan, you may end up with a required minimum distribution depending on the balance of what's in that plan.
I will eventually, yes.
Yeah.
So this is hard to answer on a very quick level during the show. You know, delaying benefits, you know, obviously, you know, past your full retirement age up to the age of 70 increases the monthly benefit, but then that gets back to a need of, you know, what are your factors, right? And trying to plan this out around, you know, there's brackets for which Social Security is taxable. There's a 50% bracket. There's an 85% bracket. Trying to plan out that in accordance with your deferred comp timing to try to minimize your tax load. So it's a little bit of a complicated question to do during this show, but you definitely should have an accountant taking a look at this for
you. Carl, thank you very much. Dawn, you want to weigh in any more on that? Okay, let's go to Rotterdam and Sandy. Sandy, you're on.
Hi, yes. I was wondering if you could collect Social Security disability, is there any benefit to filing a tax return?
That's a good question. On Social Security, I'm not an expert in Social Security benefits or Social Security disability benefits, but I would say that, you know, your tax return and whether you file a tax return, well, that depends on whether or not you've met the threshold to file a tax return. If you've met the threshold, that's not really an
regardless
option.
Of your
exactly.
source. Okay.
Correct.
How about if you haven't filed for 3 years since you've been collecting, can you go on one of these like TurboTax or IRS.com file and can you do it online yourself to go back, or do you have to?
Unfortunately, the government recently ended free file. That was part of some of the new legislation. Now, can you use TurboTax or something like that? There are a number of tax prep software companies that are commercially available at a relatively reasonable price that are question driven. So it'll just ask you questions, you enter your data, and it will guide you through the entire process. That works well for those who don't have complicated tax situations. If yours is a little more complex or involved, or you have unusual sources of income and or deduction, then perhaps you'd want to seek out the guidance of a tax professional.
All right, Sandy, thanks a lot. We'll go to Albany now. It's Jennifer's turn. 800-348-2551. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about health insurance and adding a domestic partner. So I was recently researching adding my domestic partner as someone receiving health insurance benefits, so moving from an individual plan to a family plan. Mm-hmm. But when I went to go do that, my HR office highly advised me against it, and they said it's for tax reasons and, yes, like a terrible idea. But nobody could explain why.
Maybe I can shed some light on that. Ultimately, when it comes to a domestic partner and an employer plan that will include your domestic partner, you will end up being taxed on the fair market value of that benefit. It's as if the company is paying you an additional amount to fund the domestic partner's health insurance. So I think that's perhaps why your HR professional was indicating that it's not the best tax result. However, when it comes to health insurance, perhaps that is the lower cost option because employers very often can negotiate a pretty favorable rate. It should be at the fair market value. That's the amount that your employer would have to include in your W-2. Fair market value, generally speaking, is determined by either what the COBRA rate would be or in the alternate, another measure of fair market value. So if there's a plan available on the marketplace, that might be a better economic option for you.
All right. Jennifer, thanks a lot. This email from David. Could the experts address the topic of capital gains? I know there's a threshold for the IRS. I think there's no threshold for New York State, and that's from David in Albany.
Right. So New York State does not have a special rate for capital gains that's more favorable than, you know, they have a standard rate. That's all there is.
Mm-hmm.
For federal tax purposes, yes, there's a capital gain threshold, right? So there's ordinary tax bracket. There's a capital gain threshold. You know, for 2025, the capital gains threshold ranges between 0 and 20%. 20% on a married filing joint return is reached at about $600,000. That compares to an ordinary rate that, you know, at $600,000, you're looking at, you know, you're in the 35% bracket. You hit. So it's a more favorable rate on the federal side, but state doesn't have a special rate for it.
Okay. Let's see. Let's go to one more call, maybe two, and then we'll wrap it up here with Judy Cahey and Dawn Daugherty. We'll go to Woodstock, and it's Patricia's turn. Patricia, you're on. That sounded like a phone going dead. Are you there, Patricia?
Oh, yes. Hello. Hi, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
My question is, I filed last year, a friend helped me file, and that might have been a mistake, but my husband died a year ago, October 8th. And when we filed the income for both of us. So I paid taxes for both of us, even though he's deceased. Was that right or wrong thing to do?
So we actually had a similar question to this a little bit ago. And in the year of your spouse's passing, you as a surviving spouse can still file a joint return as long as you don't remarry in the same year. So filing a joint return is proper. And as we said, it generally results in a little bit less tax being paid is more favorable.
Patricia?
It's more favorable in what way? I couldn't understand that.
So your status of married filing joint as you filed is generally more favorable than filing in a different way. Married, you know, so you know, the year of death, it would be proper to file joint.
Okay. All right, Patricia.
Okay. Then separate.
Thanks a lot for the call. Just thought of this. What if your spouse makes a lot of money in a gig employee status, mm-hmm. and you pay quarterly, you file jointly, but you pay quarterly estimated taxes, and then your spouse drops dead after you paid the tax, and then there's no more income. Can you recoup that estimated tax?
So in the year of death, you'd file joint, and you'd absolutely recoup it through reporting it on a joint return. Even, you know, on a joint return, regardless of which spouse pays in their Social Security number, you'd put that into the return.
Okay. All right.
If you filed separately or another status, you get a different issue.
So in general, now we're almost done here. We only have about 30 seconds. This has been tougher year figuring stuff out tax-wise or
yeah,
easier?
We had to do a lot of amendments because some of the rules weren't retroactive and on research and development, some business topics we didn't talk about today. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So it's been a year.
All right. Here's the last question. This is from Peter in Newport Richey, Florida. Question for Dawn. Who was your favorite revenue agent to work with while you were working for the IRS? Jim Maine, Jim Manico, Bob Pico, or Bob Berg?
Now, how could I possibly answer something like that?
Is this some insider IRS thing?
I know all of those individuals, and they're all professionals. Enjoyed every one of them.
Are the feds listening in on this? You know what? I'm now. If I've said anything to offend the federal government, I apologize. Judy Cahey and Dawn Daugherty, thanks for being here.
Our pleasure.
And we will see you in February, right?
See you in February.
All right. Support comes from Berkshire Taconic Community Foundation. Start again. couldn't really see it. Berkshire Taconic Community Foundations, awarding 4,000 grants and scholarships each year through more than 600 funds. Local giving can make an impact. More at berkshiretaconic.org. At Norman Rockwell Museum, Stockbridge, Massachusetts, new exhibition, Jazz Age Illustration, opening on Saturday, November 8th. Exhibition opening party tickets and programming found at nrm.org. Thanks again to Judy Cahey and Don Doherty for being here today. Thanks you all for listening and for calling and emailing. Thanks to Zach Malloy. Semi-awake, you made it through. A lot of jargon there. I'm with you, brother. Thanks to Susie Chekai, who screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday. We welcome back our friend Holly Shelowitz. We'll talk healthy and tasty eating with her. We'll see you at 2:00.